Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by my Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tommy Woods.
Hi.
We're in here in person in Iceland. It's quite exciting. We're sat in Tommy's mum's house in the conservatory in a very windy and quite cold Iceland. And we're going to talk about the Food Loose Iceland conference that we attended yesterday. Tommy was one of the speakers there. And there were some other very exciting people and some really interesting presentations. And I wanted to sit Tommy down and get some of his thoughts on what everybody else said.
This was, if people listened to the previous podcast, they'll have heard Gudmundur, who was the CEO of the Icelandic Health Symposium, which ran the Food Loose Conference. And we talked a bit about it. And they put together a really, really amazing day, actually. It was in the central Icelandic concert hall, the right in downtown Reykjavik, which is a very impressive building. In the main hall, there was great food all day.
It's incredible. I've been to a few conferences now and I've not been to one that good. That building it's a world-class conference center, and it's the acoustics in the hall that we sat in. How many people does that hall see?
It fits about, I think, 12 to 1500 if you've got them sort of full up to the rafters.
Right. So it's like a properly acoustically sorted center. Yeah, amazing, really, really high quality conference. And then the catering was great. You know, I've been to some conferences recently and they break for lunch and you go outside and there's this line of people that get to the food and then they leave without taking anything because they've got sandwiches, right? It's just like the standard caterers that they have for the conference center and they've not really talked to each other. Whereas this was... it was all gluten-free, sugar-free, looked like it'd been prepared by a chef. It was really high-end catering.
There was some award-winning chef who was his name, I can't remember.
Oh, really?
That actually did like winning competitions who then was brought in to cook the food.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. So why don't we start with Aseem Malhotra?
Yes, so he came onto the scene probably about 2 years ago, actually, and he was best known for, he did this piece on the morning news, like the national morning news, where he was talking about how fat isn't harmful in the diet. So he was particularly focusing on a Mediterranean-style diet, so with nuts and olive oil and things like that, and removing processed carbohydrates and sugar from the diet. And I watched that piece. This was just after I moved to Norway, so I watched it on YouTube. And there's this guy, this tall, slender, handsome Indian guy,
yeah,
who's talking about this stuff. And then they bring in this slightly overweight, haggard-looking National Health Service dietitian to tell us that he's wrong. And you look at the two in comparison, you're like, I definitely want to believe the guy who actually looks like he's healthy and in good
right.
shape. I definitely trust his opinion. Since then, he's on the news all the time, actually, talking about health. He's become a big part of Action on Sugar, trying to get a sugar tax introduced. Some people might see him, if you've heard of the Run on Fat movie, they've just done another movie based on the actual Mediterranean diet. So it's actually the later work of Ansel Keys, where he sort of gave up on his low-fat quest and then started to move towards the Mediterranean diet and a higher-fat diet. They filmed I think that's going to come out in the next few months. It was filmed, done by the same guy who made
it's Donal O'Neill, is the producer of that movie. Yeah, so I'll link to that in the show notes for this episode.
And so then he's mainly involved in sort of public health stuff now. I think he still does some cardiology, looks after some patients, but he's mainly sort of on the political track as sort of like a voice. He's part of the National Obesity Forum and the Public Health Collaboration, which are these two groups in the UK. A lot of people that I know, a lot of my friends are on those, actually doctors mainly, trying to change the dietary guidelines in the UK. And they just came out with their recent recommendations, which is that people should just eat actual food. And if that food happens to have fat in it, then you know what, that's actually not a bad thing.
Right.
And the UK has lost its mind this week because of that. But so he's sort of really the up and coming star in that area. And he talked about sugar, lots of data about the effect of sugar on health.
It was a shock and awe presentation, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A lot of bullet points and
lots
with statistics.
Of bullet points.
And, yeah.
And I've seen him speak before. And if people find it difficult to follow that kind of presentation, then it's difficult to hear him speak. But he's very passionate and he's very eloquent. So he can kind of overcome the pure volume of data that he's throwing at you. So I always enjoy hearing him speak, but he follows a very traditional presentation style. So there's a lot of information that if you're new to it, would be quite difficult to take in.
I don't know. The thing I remember from it was the image of McDonald's in Guy's Hospital.
Yeah, so he's talking about how fast food, like the fast food industry, or there's lots of fast food available in the UK and also in the US, although there are some places that are changing that. And he gives this sign which has a McDonald's. So it says Guy's and St. Thomas' Hospital, McDonald's 200 meters. And that McDonald's was in the building that I lived in when I was a junior doctor. So that McDonald's was right beneath my flat for 2 years.
It is pretty bad. It's pretty bad. And do you think his analogy, so he started talking about or comparing sugar to tobacco, which I don't think is a fair comparison, actually. But what do you think?
I think in terms of the actual health risks of sugar, I think they are nowhere near the health risks of tobacco and smoking. But I think because there are plenty of people who are completely metabolic, and they could have some sugar and it really wouldn't harm them in any way at all. I think the main comparison is the tactics that the industry uses to try and get them to the market. So they're very good at marketing to children. They're very good at sort of creating this all pervasive, you know, everything in moderation. And that message came up at the conference as well. People were asking, everybody's talked about removing sugar, low carbohydrate diets. Can't we just eat stuff in moderation? And that's definitely the message that's getting out there. And I think that's where it's come from. So they're basically getting public bodies on side, usually with some kind of financial support. And then you have very prominent people who are saying, you know, politicians and doctors saying, actually, you know what? Sugar is fine in moderation as part of a healthy diet. So then people like Asim, when they're saying, actually, you know what, just this sort of huge pervasive nature of this processed food, especially sugar in our, you know, just in our environment, is inherently damaging because of the access that we have to it. But they're just kind of, they can slowly discredit him, but because there's always somebody with a big name who can say, oh, actually, he's wrong and I disagree. Mm-hmm. So I think and it was the same with the tobacco companies a few decades ago when they were paying politicians, they were, you know, going and sort of very famously lying to Congress about the health effects of tobacco and smoking. And I think it's the tactics that are very similar rather than
right.
You can immediately compare the health effects.
Right. And then people are accusing him of being a leader of the nanny state, right? They have this concept in the UK they call the nanny state, where the government is poking their noses in a little bit too far into people's private concerns. He's right that it is pervasive or ubiquitous, the sugar is. And he showed some pictures of just the petrol stations. We call them petrol stations. I suppose you call it a gas station in the US. And just the whole place is like a candy store, right? It's like a huge candy store. And he also talked about a news agent in the UK called Smith's that's been around forever. I can remember that when I was a kid as well. And he was right that when I used to go in there as a kid, it was just magazines and newspapers. And again, now you go in there and it's like a huge candy store.
Yeah.
But the reason I don't think it's a fair comparison with tobacco is because there's a real danger of passive smoking, where there's no danger with passive sugar consumption.
Although we talked about this, and I think if you're a baby in the womb,
right,
your mum is smashing Mars bars,
right,
then I think you're being passively affected by that.
Yeah.
So maybe in that context.
Right. You get born and then you have this huge hypoglycemic episode the second you leave the womb.
No, absolutely. When those babies born to mothers with severe gestational diabetes. And the problem is that you know, we're seeing that started to cause epigenetic programming. So then those babies are at such a huge risk of developing types of diabetes and obesity much earlier in life. So it's kind of, you know, and if your grandmother did that to your mother, it sort of like gets passed down the line. So that kind of those metabolic problems then are appearing earlier and earlier in life because people are being exposed to the same environment, but also because of what happened while they were being grown.
And I should link to, we did a Paleo Baby podcast with Lily Nichols, and I should link to that in the show notes for this episode, because that was quite interesting too as well, because she's been working with women with gestational diabetes. So I'll link to that. So after Asim, it was supposed to be Gary Tarbes that came first on the lineup. And Gary flew in that morning into Iceland, and I'm not sure where he was coming from. Somewhere in the US, I believe.
Well, so he's based. He is based on the West Coast at the moment. He was talking about that. So
is it possible he flew in from the West? So that's. I mean, that's where we came from California to Iceland. It's a hell of a journey, and he probably stopped somewhere on the East Coast. So crazy. He must have been super jet lagged and really tired, and he missed his opening slot, and Asim took it. And then it was, when that talk finished, the speaker, the MC, what's her name again? Marianne DeMacy was saying, "Well, I do believe that Gary Taubes is in the building." And it was pretty funny. But it did build tension, and he didn't fail to deliver, did he? He is an extraordinary speaker. I've never seen anything like it. He has incredible presence on the stage. And then he gave this presentation without pausing or hesitating or using the word or anything. It was just continuous, rapid fire, really, really impressive. Making eye contact with the audience all the time, not really looking at his slides, only when he was going to read a short passage. Really, really powerful.
Yeah, so he was an exceptional speaker. He's really good at telling a story and trying to tie things together. And you can see why so many people have listened to him, is because he's very convincing, actually. And he's put together a really nice story of the alternative hypothesis of obesity, which is basically flipping the conventional thought on its head. And it's not that people are obese because they overeat. It's people overeat because their fat cells are overly accumulating energy, and then they need to eat more to get in the energy they need for other bodily functions. It's essentially what he was talking about. And then that's that accumulation of fat cells is driven by insulin. And he talked about the history of this alternative hypothesis, which was largely before the Second World War, when the language of science was German. And this is what people were starting to think. And then obviously after that, after the Second World War, everything switched over to English, and we basically started from scratch. And I think that we're seeing that in a number of different areas, where a huge body of science was done either in Germany or in the Soviet states, you know, in the last 100-150 years. And basically in Europe and the Western world, we're reinventing the wheel now, and they did this work, you know, 100
right.
years ago. And so when we started to do obesity research, you know, tinkering with single genes in animals and trying to pretend that actually has anything to do with humans, you know, we basically just started with the assumption that it was caused by overeating, and then everything is based on that assumption. Whereas actually, if you go back and look at some of the other factors that are involved, then, you know, we basically started, everything's based on an essentially incorrect assumption. And then, you know, you can almost pull down 100 years of obesity research in one go.
I thought it was really interesting the way he talked about the history of how we got to where we are today. And he made the comparison with physics, which is where Gary Taubes really came from. And he talked about how you don't just learn, you know, a theory. It's almost got a name attached to it, like Einstein's theory of relativity. And as a physicist, you learn about the history of that theory because it's important, right? It yeah. means something. And you don't really do that in nutrition science. And Gary Taubes came to this. He tells the story about how, you know, he was an investigative journalist and was really interested in bad science. And somebody said to him, "Oh, well, if you want to see some bad science, you should check out nutrition. You'd love that." And that's how he got into it. But yeah, he did a really good job of building up to that kind of, he built suspense really well in the presentation. You're like, "Oh, come on." Like, by the time he gets to the, like, starts talking about insulin, I'm like, "Oh, come on, Gary, just like, what, tell me why people get fat." You know, you're like really hankering for the answer. And yeah, amazing. I don't know how long he talked for, but he must have gone well over an hour.
Yeah,
and no one was timing him.
I know. And actually that was the same for all the speakers. Everybody was sort of given, and it meant the day overran hugely, but it was nice that there was sort of no sort of pressure and people just talked as long as yeah. they naturally needed to. But apparently when they were setting up the schedule, he said, "I physically cannot talk for half an hour. I can talk for a minimum of 50 minutes.
Oh, really?
He was like, "Yeah." So apparently he was just like, I can't tell my story in 30 minutes. It's impossible.
Right.
So that's, and I think he's clearly given that talk a great number of times.
Yeah.
But then sort of when we see the stuff that came later in the day, so he's obviously built up a very good story about, you know, sort of the truth behind, you know, the dietary guidelines and how that may have affected the obesity epidemic and how that affects how we get fat. But actually when it comes to applying that knowledge to kind of help people go in the other direction, I don't really think he has very much experience in that.
Right,
and,
no.
And you see that. We did a panel discussion at the end where people were asking for advice about things like that. And then it very clearly becomes obvious that, you know, he's like, there are two different questions here. One is how the dietary guidelines and the science was done wrong and how that affected our health. And then there's the there's how to reverse that.
Right.
And it was quite clear that that second part was not his forte.
Right.
And it's sort of like but it's that kind of teaching people the history is really good. But then how you then put that knowledge to reverse it was something that he just hadn't done nearly as much of.
And I thought he behaved very much like an investigative journalist still. Mm-hmm. He's still, I kind of had him in my mind, sort of in my mind's eye, as slightly arrogant, as someone that had come in from the outside and figured it out and was just thinking everybody was stupid for not realizing the same thing. But when I saw him yesterday, he seemed like an investigative journalist. He was very inquisitive and he was, you know, asking Tim Noakes questions and asking some of the other doctors, the cardiologists, questions. And that was quite a surprise to me. And Travis Christofferson is kind of the same. He's technical. Travis is a molecular biologist, but he's also an investigative journalist and he's extremely inquisitive. And it's really nice to see that, you know, like, you know, that I'm sure he would change his mind again if he were to be proven wrong. But do you think he is wrong? Are you a fan of his insulin hypothesis?
So I definitely think he's on the right track. He's almost still conforming to the idea that obesity is purely due to an energy balance problem, but just that it comes from the other direction, right? That you're being forced to overeat because of hormonal issues, and that's purely due to insulin and carbohydrates. But I think it's a bit more complicated than that, and there are other things involved. And so he gave this example of all these. So he was saying that obesity isn't purely to do with affluence and the availability of these poor, you know, nutritionally poor, energy dense, carbohydrate based foods, which is what obviously we have around us nowadays. Because if you go back 100 to 50 years, you see all these populations around the world, particularly parts of the US and then some Pacific islands and places like that. Then these are people who are in abject poverty, but still a good proportion of the population are overweight and obese. And then he blames it solely on the carbohydrates that they're eating. But then obviously what I spoke about much later about all the other things that are important for health. And, you know, these are people who are chronically stressed, not sleeping in, you know, they are in abject poverty, you know, and these are people who cannot do the things that it takes to do to be healthy. And the body is in such a hugely stressed state where, you know, if you're not sleeping properly, you completely dysregulate all of your appetite hormones, you know, same with chronic stress. So yes, the fact that the only food they had were refined carbohydrates is a part of that. But if they weren't in that situation to begin with, then I don't think it would be that much of an issue. So he's blaming purely the food when, you know, these are people who are in such terrible living conditions that has to be the trigger in my mind. And then the food, you know, is just part of that. So I think he's definitely right. In part, but I just think it's more complicated than that, and we have to accept that. And it's very similar that there's the paper that came out in Nutrition Journal. I guess it's almost 2 years ago now, and it was somehow created by Nina Teichholz, because she's in the acknowledgements, and it's very much in line with her book, The Big Fat Surprise. You know, in terms of the dietary guidelines and how that correlated with the obesity epidemic, and they look at population data in the US, the NHANES data, which is basically where you call people up and you ask them how they ate in the last 24 hours. And then you actually assume that has anything to do with their health outcomes. And basically it shows, you know, they show that people are eating more carbohydrates since the dietary guidelines were introduced. Although, and then they tried to say that this reduced the proportion of fat in the diet, but that's only, the fat didn't change. It's just they added more carbs essentially. But the problem is, and so they used this to show that since the dietary guidelines came into practice, people did what they were told and they ate more carbs. And they actually ate more calories in total because they just added carbs on top. But what's actually the case is that data is so unreliable. People are underreporting by, you know, up to 1,000 calories a day. And more than 50% of the NHANES data, you know, has been calculated to be physiologically implausible. So basically what what people are saying they're eating, they're just not eating. And this is particularly important. The more overweight people are, the more shame there is involved with eating. So the more they underreport their calories, right, and underreport their intake. So this group of people, you know, who are gaining weight, they're the people we want the data on, and they're the people on whom the data is the most inconsistent. So, you know, this is all part of a very interesting story, but actually, you know, we don't have the data to support it. And it's a nice idea that the dietary guidelines just suddenly screwed us. But I really think that there's so much else that's involved. And that's a lot to do with the food that is available to us and all the other stuff that's involved in modern life. And there's lots of things that happened since the 1970s and 1980s that coincided with the obesity epidemic and now the type 2 diabetes epidemic, as much as just an increasing availability of carbohydrates. So it's a really interesting story. And I think it is a big part of what's happened. But I think there's more to it.
Do you think they're ever going to solve that problem? Because we have metabolic ward studies now, but even those, you know, if we're going to say, okay, this is a bit more complicated than that, and any solution that it just involves one variable like insulin is probably going to be wrong, and the stress and the sleep and all the rest of that, then even if you put someone in a metabolic ward and you're quite confident about understanding what's going on with their metabolism, you still don't really know how that would be different from their real life.
You can't answer that question because people don't live in a metabolic ward.
Exactly.
Right. It's like, right? So it's really nice. You can have Kevin Hall, who'll spend millions of government dollars, you know, trying to disprove the insulin hypothesis by, you know, doing very, very accurate, detailed measurements and kind of make his own decisions, which is fine. We've kind of talked a little bit about those before. But that literally has absolutely nothing to do with what a person does in real life.
Right.
You know, so we can try and understand the physiology, but that, you know, there's so much more to, you know, there's so much more psychology and environmental influences that will then completely change that, which what probably will never be able to measure.
Yeah, slightly depressing, but that's life, folks. So next up, it was Dr. Axel Sigurdsson. Did I say that right?
Axel Sigurdsson.
Sigurdsson.
Yeah.
Okay. And he's an Icelandic cardiologist. Is that right too? Or is he originally from Sweden?
No, he's Icelandic.
So he was an interesting guy. I think you know him better than I do. Why don't you tell us a little bit about him?
Yeah, so he's an Icelandic cardiologist, and he started writing leaflets, particularly about diet and lifestyle, for his patients in Icelandic maybe 10 or 15 years ago, just as like a small blog, like literally at the beginning of the internet. And then he transitioned to a website based in English, which is called docsopinion.com, which some people might have seen, which is based mainly around heart disease and the factors of heart disease and lifestyle factors, different diets, and a lot to do with like how to understand your cholesterol numbers, like what your LDL cholesterol means, whether that's actually bad, maybe better things like your triglyceride to HDL ratio, stuff like that. And he's just a really solid, sensible guy. And that's what I really like. Is he's purely evidence driven, and he's never been dragged into sort of the emotional side of things. So when he's talking about low carbohydrate diets for people with cardiovascular disease, you know, he says, you know, these are the things we see. I think there's some benefit there, but you know, that doesn't mean that that's the only solution, or that we've definitely proven that they'll stop you getting cardiovascular disease, because that data doesn't exist. And then people are like, well, how can you say that? How can you be ambiguous? And he's like, because I'm just, all I can do is tell you the data that exists. Mm. And that's very frustrating to people, because he can't give you a yes, no answer, because he's just, you know, he's so balanced. Mm-hmm. So I know some people don't like that. And it's the same with statins. So he was asked about statins, and he says that he does still prescribe statins, but mainly for secondary prevention So people who've already had a heart attack, to prevent them having another heart attack, where the evidence is slightly better, and probably more so in men, because they men seem to do better on statins than women do. And I could tell that there was some pushback about that, just because he was prescribing statins at all.
Yeah.
But, you know,
I must admit my opinion of him did go down.
Yeah, and that's the standard reaction, right? But the thing is, we are not cardiologists and we don't work with these patients day to day. And so I think the scenario when they're coming into play is when you have somebody who comes into your clinic who has had a heart attack, is in bad shape, and you talk to them about the lifestyle stuff, and they're like, "Do you know what, doc? Just give me a pill."
Yeah.
And then actually, you know, regardless of what you think of the trials, which are hugely flawed and hugely biased and always overstate, you know, the importance, you know, like the benefit from the drug and understate the negative sides of the drugs, you know, there is data to suggest that they may be beneficial. So it's, you know, a good doctor who can't get the other stuff to be done, can't get the lifestyle interventions in place, would prescribe a statin. That's the state of the evidence we have currently. And I certainly don't begrudge him that, because I know he has read literally everything. You know, he knows all the data and he's very clever. So
yeah, and you have to understand the context. And that's something that I've come to appreciate recently when I interviewed Jason Fung for the Keto Summit. Was up until that point, I really didn't understand Jason's context. So he was talking about a 75-year-old patient that had been in his office that morning, 400 pounds, type 2 diabetes, you know, in danger of, you know, maybe losing a leg or a kidney or something like that. And, you know, what am I going to do for that guy? Like, talk to him about hyperpalatable food? I don't think so. Like, you need to do something.
He just needs to stop
eating. He just needs to stop eating for 2 years, literally. So yeah, the context is important. So, and it's not like Axel is prescribing statins for all.
No, absolutely. And he did talk about how they are overprescribed, particularly for primary prevention. So he made that point. You know, it's not that he's doing the traditional job. He's just now using them as a targeted intervention where they may actually be beneficial.
And it was interesting to me that I met a local businessman called Helgi. Hi, Helgi, you might be listening to this podcast. And we had lunch together, and he discovered a low carbohydrate diet through his friend that went to the doctor and was told, okay, you've got two options. You can either have a low carbohydrate diet or you can have a statin drug. And I thought that was incredible that a doctor had said that to him.
Yeah.
And he said, okay, I'll try the low carbohydrate diet. And he immediately lost 25 kilos or over the course of the next few weeks. And Helgi was like, at the beginning, he was, no way. Like, this is quackery. Like, I can't understand it. This could never work. And then, of course, he did the same and also lost 25 kilos. I think that's been incredibly progressive. I've not heard about that in any other country.
Yeah, and I think this is part of what we talked about with Goodmundur on the last podcast. And that's something that I think he's been quite instrumental in, and Axel has been instrumental in. There's this group of doctors, particularly online, you know, where they've got like 20% of all the doctors in Iceland, and they're continuously posting stuff to do with lifestyle medicine, diet, and how that affects health. You know, there's a lot to do with cardiovascular disease, low carbohydrate diets. So, and because there's such a small, tight-knit community of doctors in Iceland, you know, you actually have access to almost the majority. And then, you know, the hall we went to yesterday was full of doctors, you know, and again, you know, you probably have 5-10% of the doctors in Iceland were there or know about the conference, reading about the conference in the newspapers. So because it's such a small community, you have access, direct access to these people, which means it's much more likely that they're going to change their mind because there isn't this huge body of resistance. Mm-hmm. So I truly do think if it's ever going to change anywhere, it's going to change here. And it's going to change because of people like Axel and Goodmundur, because they, you know, in Iceland, you can call up your mate who's the dean of the medical school and say, do you know what? You need to teach your doctors about nutrition. And they're like, oh yeah, fine. Just come and do it. You know, and stuff changes, can change like that overnight, as long as, you know, you know, people are receptive. And I think that's really starting to happen.
Yeah, that's phenomenal, I think. So who would next? Professor Tim Noakes, wasn't it? Tim was great.
I was so excited to meet him. It was really great to listen to him talk.
Yeah, it was. I didn't think he would remember me. So he's been on my podcast before, and I'll link to that. But I didn't think he would remember me, because surely he has done hundreds, if not thousands, of podcasts with, you know, random people from the internet that's been arranged by his personal assistant. And he looked at me. I shook his hand, And I was right. I don't think he initially recognized me, but the moment I started speaking, the light went on. He goes, oh yeah, as soon as you spoke, I knew exactly who you were. And he's just such a lovely guy. And you see these pictures of him and he's kind of got his kooky smile there. In the picture I'm looking at on this, that's really what he's like. He just doesn't all the time. He doesn't stop smiling. He's a very likable guy. So what was the hypothesis? I can't remember much about the presentation.
So he talked about insulin resistance, right? And he started with some data from himself,
right?
You know, back when he was 30 or something, and it was looking at
it's from the 70s.
Yeah. So they were trying to.
This is a guy that's written 700 or published 750. Scientific studies, right? Yeah. Which is pretty amazing in itself. But this was one of the really early ones where they looked at ketones and glucose and insulin.
Yeah, so what they were trying to prove is that you need carbohydrates to fuel marathon running.
Right.
And then to as a comparator, they did a very low carbohydrate diet. So they had three different days where one day they ate like normal carbs. One day and maybe they ate it for 2 or 3 days beforehand, and then they ate a low carbohydrate diet beforehand, and then there was another day, there was like a control day.
Mm-hmm.
And then the interesting thing that he saw was that his fasting insulin on the control day was almost 30.
Yeah, it was 30, between 30 and 40. You can see the exact number.
Which is incredible. And so then he was looking back and he was like, so I was doing all this running, I was eating all these refined carbohydrates, and I was insulin resistant already back then. And then he was already on the track of becoming type 2 diabetic, which obviously is now, which has to control with his diet. And then he obviously talked about his book and The Law of Running.
And he's rewriting that book, he said. And he said the first four chapters have been ripped out. They're in the bin.
Yeah, it was brilliant because he was talking. Because I was sat next to my mum, actually. And he gave some quotes from the beginning of the book about how important carbohydrates are. And she looked at me and she's like, wait, this doesn't sound right. And then he was like, all of that is nonsense. It's all wrong. I had to tear all of that out of the book. Which I've heard about before, that now, and he's actually done it in public, apparently. You know, when he was talking about the book, he just like physically tears the chapters out.
He loves doing that. He's an amazing guy. I wonder why there's not more people like him, you know, that have seen that they were wrong and fessed up, said, you know what, I was wrong about all that crap.
Yeah.
And he seems to be the only one doing that. And I can't really understand why. We were talking about this last night. Like, we don't understand where his funding comes from. Why did he? I mean, he's been excommunicated from the university and.
Yeah, I have no idea how he makes money anymore. So he's still technically an emeritus professor. But that's not usually a paid position. It just means that you are still,
right.
You have sort of some professor's rights at the university you used to be based at. He's been excommunicated. He can't do anything to do with the medical students or the medical school. Then apparently he was saying that if any medical student mentions a low carb diet, they essentially, you know, so the dean of the medical school came out directly against Noakes, saying he was wrong. You know, you need carbs for whatever. And so then if any medical student mentions a low carb diet, they're immediately brought up to the dean of the medical school because they have actively spoken against the dean of the medical school because they've said something that he disagrees with. So I don't know. I'm not sure how he does it, but you know, he's obviously, got his book. He probably has some people who sort of support him, I guess, and his message and his work. So
it was the Noakes Foundation was what was written on all of his slides.
Yeah.
And he talks about a new book that he's just finished reading. Writing, called Making Little Superhumans or something.
Raising Superheroes.
That's it. So I was thinking about reading that book and then talking to him about that for the Keto Summit, because I think that's really interesting. And obviously, he's in a spot of bother at the moment for something he said in public concerning weaning children onto high-fat diets.
Yeah.
But we were talking about this morning, we think he's been kind of forced to say something he didn't really mean by the brevity of Twitter. You've only got 128 characters. And we were like trying to think of a way that we could say this.
Yeah, how do you tell somebody... and I guess the problem is that he, you know, the issue that they take is he gave nutrition advice and stuff that they question. He did it via Twitter. But I mean, people do this all day, every day, you know, there's hundreds of doctors, nutritions on Twitter, and they do this stuff all the time, which has questioning legality. or questionable legality. But how in 140 characters, they've changed it now, right?
So did I say 128? Yeah, 140.
No. But now actually, if you include a link or you include somebody's Twitter handle, that now doesn't count. It just changed last week. That now doesn't count.
Oh, really?
So you can actually have 140 characters of actual text as well as all the other guff that goes in. But anyway, how do you tell somebody in 140 characters to wean their kid onto like actual real food that they have cooked themselves from single ingredients?
Right.
You know,
you can't. You can only link to something.
Yeah. So he just said wean onto low carb, high fat, which I don't think he really meant, because there's no reason why your kid can't eat fruit, right? But it's just to kind of, you know, that's the, in South Africa they call it the Banting diet, right? That's mm-hmm. that's how they phrase it, based on Roger Banting, and that. I think it just got a little bit lost in translation. Then it was picked up by some nutritionists, some nutrition associations. And then, you know, he's obviously gotten the trouble that he's gotten into. And it's been really nasty. You know, he's really been dragged through the mud.
And I think he had to cut his trip short to go back face the music there.
Yeah, he was going to stay for longer, but they keep on putting off this tribunal or whatever hearing. And so he had to go back for that again.
And it was quite dramatic, the style of his presentation as well. It was all... He would present one slide with a bunch of information, you know, like how carbohydrates are essential for marathon runners and all of that. And then he would slap on top of it, you know, like another slide that didn't entirely cover the original slide, showing why it was wrong.
Yeah.
It was that kind of that, you could see that he'd gone for that style.
It was very, again, it was, you know, he presented some really nice old work. And that's what I think is really important, because there's some... Back when science was good, you know, maybe 20 or 30 years ago, because everything else, not everything, but so much stuff that's been done recently is just nonsense. So back when like physiologists were, you know, really meticulous, and they didn't have to worry, you know, they didn't have to worry about funding. They didn't have to worry about publication, you know, just publishing as much as possible. They didn't have to, they just didn't live in the same environment, and they could just do good work. They didn't have to worry about statistically mining their data to try and find something interesting that would then some editor at a journal would like it. Then, you know, the physiology was really good. And actually, you know, he presented some old data about how carbohydrates aren't essential and how eating carbohydrates especially increase your level, the level of triglycerides in your blood. That's what he focused on a lot, was the triglycerides in the blood. And it was another kind of sort of shock and awe tactic presentation, but it was very polished, and I enjoyed it a lot. But it was also, he's very strict about carbohydrate restriction in the setting of insulin resistance. He's like, if you're insulin resistant, you cannot have any carbohydrates, full stop. But, you know, and it's almost like I didn't expect him to say this. He was like, there are lots of people who are insulin sensitive and then carbs are fine.
Right.
You know, he did actually give that message, which I was...
In fact, he showed a slide with the double arrows, didn't he?
Yeah.
Where he talked about people on one side of the scale who would be fine with excess carbohydrates, and those people would be insulin sensitive and probably athletes.
Yeah.
And then the unfortunate insulin resistant people, of which he is one, who are just going to kill themselves if they eat carbs.
Yeah. Which, if you're... So, and we've talked about this now off mic a lot, and there's definitely a case of, there are lots of things that cause insulin resistance which aren't just dietary. But if the only thing that you can fix is your diet, then definitely you're going to have to restrict carbs in that setting. But there are also plenty of people who eat lots of carbs and they do just fine. So we have to be able, that has to fit into the theory, right? You can't just say that no human can eat carbs, because that's, you know, we don't have the evidence for that either. So he covered all areas of the spectrum, which I actually enjoyed.
He's also a very evidence driven person.
Yeah.
He won't say if he doesn't know, he hasn't read all the literature on a subject, he refuses to answer.
Yeah. So again, during the panel discussion, he was asked about ketones as an alternate fuel for the brain. And I think it was specifically to do with Alzheimer's disease. But he basically said, you know, I haven't read all the papers about ketosis and Alzheimer's disease, so I can't really give you a good answer. It's really nice when people actually admit that they don't know something that's really important.
But, you know, I mean, when I hear that answer, I bet he has. I bet he's read more than most people,
but he's
still not at the point where he's willing to comment.
Yeah, absolutely.
So next up, it was Denise Minger. And Denise Minger, I'm sure, in fact, I know that, so you can have... too much of one thing in your conference, right? You can put a lump of sugar in your coffee and it makes it sweeter and better. And then you put another lump in, it maybe makes it a little bit better, but there's certainly a plateau there, and more sugar in your coffee does not make it better, right? Like there's a diminishing returns. And I think they thought the same about this conference. And if they just had people talking about low carbohydrate diets, then eventually it would just become too one-dimensional and not as interesting. So they brought in Denise Minger to give the opposing view. And she did a talk that I've heard before, actually, the carbosis thing. And she's written about this on her blog.
Yeah.
Maybe you should explain the hypothesis.
Yeah, so actually, it was me who recommended her. It's
Tommy.
It was me. And I wanted her for exactly that reason. So they, just because... I think it's really important. And she started with, you know, she had a slide which said, question everything.
Yeah.
And I just think it's why? And I think it's really important to, you know, when there's this continued low carb, carbs are evil message, it's important, even if it's not practically, you can't practically apply it to most people. It's really important to know that very good data exists of people on very low fat diets actually seeing benefit for whatever reason. Like that data exists. We can't say that if all you eat is sugar, you'll get sick, because there are actually diabetics who, you know, about 80 years ago, all they ate was sugar for days and their diabetes got better. I mean, that actually happened. So we have to, you know, people just need to know. And again, this comes back to history, right? You need to know some of this old science. And you know, as we move into the future, we need to be able to understand both sides of the story and how they come together. So that's what she talked about. She talked about all the low fat proponents. Actually, she only talked up to Ansel Keys. So everybody always talks about how Ansel Keys came in and made fat the devil. But there were four or five doctors before him, who people like Roy Swank with MS, Lester Morrison, who was mainly looking at heart disease, even though he was a gastroenterologist. You know, these guys were doing this stuff well before Ansel Keys came onto the stage. So she was giving us like the new version of the history of the low fat diet, but also actually, you know, showing that these people did studies which were actually for the time very well performed and well controlled studies that actually saw benefit in their patients. And it's just to kind of show that there's not always one way that has to be the same for everybody.
And it was the rice diet. I should link to this rice diet and Denise's article.
Yeah, Walter Kempner's rice diet.
Walter Kempner's rice diet. It's absolutely ludicrous. It was unlimited white sugar, unlimited fruit, unlimited white rice. It was like 2,000 calories of sugar per day.
Yeah.
But incredibly low fat. Yeah. I just can't imagine, like, this diet must have been hideously unpalatable, says the guy that eats a high-fat diet that most people would think of as being hideously unpalatable. But there were some really interesting pictures that she had. I've never really seen that in a study where they've got before and after pictures of these people that came in with obesity and all kinds of other problems, and they showed these old black and white pictures of how they looked afterwards.
People losing huge amounts of weight. And I know that Jason Fung has particularly focused on the rice diet and said that actually probably what happened is people hugely calorie restricted because the diet was so miserable. But actually the same thing naturally happens on a low carb diet.
Yeah.
People naturally calorie restrict. So actually, you know, there might be some benefit there. And that maybe that's maybe why they saw some of those benefits. But, you know, it was quite impressive, some of the results that she was showing.
Do you respect the quality of that data, though? Earlier on, we talked about how all the nutrition science was junk. Like, what makes you think that this data was any better?
Yeah, so I actually haven't read these studies. And I will ask Denise for them, or to at least show me where the references are so that I can read them. And I'm sure there are flaws in there, and I'm sure that they're not as meticulously reported as maybe things can be nowadays. But similarly, the environment of science back then was very much, you know, there wasn't this kind of push to find statistical significance, which maybe people would find frustrating now, but there was very much a, this is what we did, this is what we saw.
Mm-hmm.
And so I definitely believe that these people were eating what they were told to eat. What the actual calorie intake was maybe a little, we don't know. And then I believe that they, you know, accurately reported the results, because that's what people were very good at back then, was just at, you know, here's where we started, this is what we did, and then very good at reporting what they saw, because that's the only metric they had. They couldn't really dig into it any deeper because they didn't have the methods that we have now. And I think there's some benefit to that. So I would be tempted to believe the data that she presented.
And could I persuade you to speculate on the mechanism of how a pure sugar diet could cure type 2 diabetes?
So I think at least part of it, at least part of it is probably going to come from calorie restriction. So, I mean, maybe some of these people were eating 5,000 calories a day of sugar. That's perfectly possible. But so I think what's happening is when you have a mixed diet, I have talked about insulin resistance just being a cellular response to stresses in the diet. And those stresses come from, in my opinion, inflammation, oxidative stress, and total cellular energy load, or inappropriate cellular energy load. And that includes both the total amount of energy and then where that energy is coming from. And when you metabolize carbohydrates, you know, they purely come through glycolysis and enter the electron transport chain at complex one. And that's very different from fats, which kind of, you know, if you go, so polyunsaturated fats are kind of somewhere in the middle, and then fully long chain, fully saturated fats kind of almost come 50-50 into complex one and complex two. And what happens is if you have fat and carbohydrate coming in at the same time, they basically inhibit each other. So especially fat inhibits carbohydrate metabolism, and saturated fat especially is very good at driving insulin resistance because of the way it generates reactive oxygen species within the mitochondria, and where the electrons come from FADH2 into complex two more than into complex one. And that's just a normal signaling mechanism. It's not necessarily a bad thing. But when somebody is insulin resistant, that kind of competition in the electron transport chain causes a backlog, which then causes insulin resistance, which then causes all those metabolic processes to break down. And what I think is happening is if you remove that element of competition and you bring down the total calorie load, I think that basically takes the load off the cell. And, mm-hmm. and you can either do that by dramatically reducing carbohydrates or by dramatically reducing fat. And just by removing that level of competition, you take the brakes off. And these people will have had, you know, very poorly functioning mitochondria that can't uncouple. So if you just have extra energy that you don't know what to do with, a healthy body, a healthy mitochondria would just offload that by uncoupling it, right? Like the protons will just spin through the inner mitochondrial membrane, and you'll just lose that as heat. But if somebody's already like really sick, they can't do that. The mitochondria are incapable of doing that. And then you cause this backlog. So I think you fix that just by getting rid of that competitive element.
So you don't put butter on your potato.
Don't put butter on your potato.
Right. You have your butter, you have your potato, but not at the same time.
Yeah. So you could, I think theoretically, if you spread them out enough, you could. So one day you could eat just carbs and the next day you could eat just fat, as long as there was enough time for those to make their way through the system. I think that is possible. But you just can't handle them together. And there's something called the Randall cycle and the reverse Randall cycle, which is basically how fat and carbohydrate metabolism at the level above the mitochondria, sort of in the cytosol, actively compete with one another. Mm-hmm. And you're also helping at that level. So you're helping at multiple levels. And it's just that, you know, in those kind of people who are metabolically broken, if we can call it that, they just can't handle that for whatever reason, all the things that have happened up to that point. So you basically fix them by just removing one or the other.
It was interesting at the end, Ivor Cummings stood up and he asked the same question that I asked Denise the first time I saw her give that talk, which was, you know, when you're looking for an engineering solution to a problem, there's always options which are in theory possible, but in practice impossible, and so are useless. And this is one of them, right? So you can't really get people to eat pure white sugar and bananas and white rice. They're just never going to stick to that diet. And one of the beauties of a low carbohydrate, high fat, moderate protein diet is it's effortless, right? You can have effortless weight loss. And you know, Gary Tarbes talks about this, how he gets mobbed by old ladies that thank him for taking away their hunger and their cravings and all these other problems. And it's totally effortless for them. They're not having to think about restricting their food particularly.
But if you think about the other side of that, so maybe nobody's going on a pure white rice and sugar diet, but If you look at the more recent work of Dean Ornish, and then I guess the real proponent of that nowadays, sort of like the most public mouthpiece, is Michael Greger, who are very, you know, whole foods, plant-based diet people. Mm-hmm. So actually you're taking that low-fat diet and you're actually adding nutrition to it, because you're actually eating, they're eating lots of vegetables, lots of legumes, you know, they're actually getting really nutrient-dense diets. They're suggesting lots of spices, turmeric, like getting lots of polyphenols and all this other stuff from the diet. And they see these same miraculous results. They just do. And you're doing the same thing. You're removing that level of metabolic competition. And we just have to accept that. And so Denise talked about the fact that there was one person who she knew who was working with a doctor near her who started like low carb paleo and just kept gaining weight, couldn't do it, even though, you know, they were doing the diet right. Then they switched over to like a super strict low fat vegan diet and all the weight fell off them and they felt mm-hmm. amazing. So if we go back to Michael Greger, I've read his book, which is actually, if you might have seen his videos on nutritionfacts.org, which is just these amazing.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, exactly. So these amazing like cognitive dissonance, cherry picking kind of studies, basically telling you about why fat is evil and you can't eat meat and it's full of toxins and it's going to kill you. And the videos are, they're just hilarious more than anything, because yeah. actually, if you look at the data that he's reading, you're like, Michael, I just don't see the same data that you're telling us about. It's not there. But if you read, I really enjoyed his book, even though that kind of, you know, the vegan tinge is in there. Actually, it's really sensible. And he doesn't even say that nobody should eat meat. He's just like, you know what? Eat a lot of plants. You know, so in that context, eat a lot of plants, eat a lot of good stuff. And, you know, if you're going to eat meat, just make it really good quality stuff. And, you know, on that side, you're probably really going to reduce your fat intake. And then you've sort of gone the other way. And he sees people get a lot of benefit from it. So, and then in a very similar world, you have Rich Roll, you have Ray Cronise, you know, these right. are the guys talking about essentially the same diet and they're seeing these same results. So Ray Cronise does a lot to do with, cold thermogenesis as well. That's a big part of his protocol. I truly believe that these people are seeing a benefit and there is a metabolic reason for it. And I think we can explain it. Does that mean that, you know, so then the problem is that then they automatically assume that the other end of the spectrum, you know, the low carb diets can't work or they're unhealthy because they're not the diet that they recommend, which isn't the case. I think you can go in both directions, and you know, one might work for one person rather than another. You know, the vegan diet is definitely going to support the gut microbiome better. Whether we know what the outcome of that is, we probably don't yet, but you're definitely going to have a lot more fermentable fibers and things like that than the average low carb diet, which is, I think, there's a problem with a lot of low carb diets. It's possible to get benefit from both sides. So the problem is that just because people have become proponents of one, they automatically assume that everybody else is wrong. But I don't think that's the case.
And Denise was another person. She was a really good presenter, wasn't she?
Yeah.
She spoke beautifully. They fitted everyone with these, you know, Madonna mics where they hook behind your ears and you've got like the little mic next to your mouth. And Denise didn't take one of those, did she? She stood up at the lectern and did put her mouth really close to the mic and did the whole presentation that way. And that seems like a much harder strategy to me, but she really pulled it off. And
yeah.
Did it really, really well.
She's obviously given it a few times before. She was very polished and she's very self-deprecating and funny.
She is. She is very funny, very humorous, very likable. Mm. I did enjoy that, even if her information is useless. So who's this guy that was next?
Yeah, so then they had me finish it.
I was so happy for him. It was really, really good. It definitely, you know, after all of that low-carb talk, you know, I'm sat there thinking, oh God, like how can you just, if all these people are new and it's their first time they're really thinking about what it's going to take to be healthy and live a long time and maybe be a good athlete, then how can you talk for this long without mentioning all the other stuff, right? It's not just about low carb, high carb, or even any type of food thing. There's so many other things that are important. And so your talk, I mean, it like really, I don't know. I thought yours was probably the most important talk there.
Yeah, thanks. This was something that Goodman did ask me to do, to kind of like tie things together and talk about some of the other stuff. Well, maybe I offered to do it because, you know, everybody else, why would I stand up and talk about insulin resistance when Tim Noakes has just done it?
Right.
That's just idiotic. So I kind of figured, I've spoken in front of the Icelandic audience before, and I kind of felt like I knew the kind of information that they were looking for, and it was, you know, practical answers to some of the things that maybe they've heard about, but, you know, that information isn't just generally really easily available in Iceland. And also there's a little bit of a language barrier, so you can use a lot of technical language, and Icelanders are very good at English, but not all of them are. And sort of I'm very used to, so my family is very good at speaking English, and I, you know, if you hang out with doctors and academics, then they're very good at speaking English because they've often studied abroad and things like that. But some of the general population, when you're throwing really technical information at them, you know, they don't really follow you. And I've fallen into that trap before. So I tried to kind of stay away from that as much as possible. And just, you know, present some really basic data and basic ideas just to kind of give a real overview and give people some practical takeaways.
That was nice, actually, your style, where you just, you know, here's this thing, stress, here's this thing, sleep. And you gave me just enough technical, evidence-driven background context. And then you quickly transition to this. Okay, so how do I act on this? Just tell me what to do.
Yeah.
I really enjoy that, you know, kind of the having the practical implications and the instructions embedded within the content rather than just waiting until the end and like a big long summary. And I've kind of forgotten what you said earlier. Yeah. And that was really good. So what did you talk about? What were the things?
Yeah, so I talked about four things that I thought were really important. And actually it was really nice. And I got to make fun of Tim Noakes a little bit. Because he, during his talk, he said, oh yeah, of course there are other things that are important for health, like lifestyle, blah, blah, blah. And then at the start of my talk, I was like, so Tim Noakes said there are some things, some blah, blah, blah things that are also important. And that's what I'm going to talk about. So I talked about movement, and not exercise, but actually, you know, mainly, just moving frequently and the benefits of that. Why sitting for long periods of time is maybe a bad thing. And also the other side of that, why too much exercise can be bad and just sort of like an extra stress on that the body doesn't need. So that was the first thing. I sort of started slightly conventional and then I talked about stress and how that's very different from person to person. It's not the stressor. It's how your body responds to it. And, you know, so there is no such thing as stress, right? It's just how you respond to a stressor, which technically is in your control, but it's another one of those things that the answer is simple, but that doesn't mean it's easy to do it.
Right.
And so we talked about job stress and how job stress increases, heart disease. And then also how diet stress and stressing about the diet has been shown to dramatically increase cortisol without having, you know, you can be, so you can study women and you look at how restricted they feel in their diet. And all it does is it makes their weight fluctuate more and it makes their cortisol higher, but they don't lose weight and they can exercise more and they also don't lose weight. They're the same weight as women who aren't actively restricting their diet and just eating however they feel they should eat. So actually just worrying about what you eat can have a negative impact on your health. And I thought that was really important because we've heard all these mixed messages by this point because we've got the low carbers, then these finger turns up and then people are like, well, what the hell should I eat? So, and then, you know, just talked about how, you know, there's so much. The problem is it's really difficult to synthesize the stress data because stress is such a nebulous concept. Right. So it's really difficult to quantify it, but you can actually look at people and different types of stressors. And then you can look at their different inflammatory cytokines. And we know how those affect our cardiovascular parameters. And we know how those affect long-term health. So actually, if you can piece it all together, you can see that it's really, really important for health. It's just, you can't do a huge randomized controlled trial of it because how do you fix an intervention, get everybody to do the same thing? And you just can't do it.
Yeah, exactly. So think about me standing up there giving Gary Tarbes. Imagine if someone said to me, here's Gary's deck. He couldn't be here. Yeah. You give his presentation, right? That would be pretty stressful for me and it would be awful actually. But then maybe the opposite, you could put, you know, switch shoes and say to Gary Tarbes, here's a mountain bike. I want you to ride that 25 miles an hour down this single track.
Yeah.
You know, there's like big step downs and rocks of 14 inches or more. And he would probably find that quite stressful. Whereas I do that every day.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very difficult. I don't know. Again, it's like one of those things, like how the hell would you design a study?
Yeah, you just can't do it. So you just have to make people realize that there are these stresses in their lives. And then actually the things that you can do are with meditation, mindfulness. And we know a lot of people that have benefited a lot from that. But also, you know, to just identify your stresses, talk about them, or try and figure out ways to respond to them in a different way. And again, it's not necessarily that you can give people simple fixes, but you can help them realize that they are essentially in control of that. And then if you give them that control back, then they can start to get on top of it.
Mm. I think it's, I mean, one of the things that I find is a great stress reliever is thinking about the fact that it's always going to be okay. If you're listening to this podcast, I'm really got no doubt that the same is true for you, right? You're always going to have your basic needs met. You're always going to have shelter. You're always going to have food. You're almost going to have water. If those are the not, and that's really all you need, right? Like when you've got those basic needs, everything else is really not that important.
And but the stress is always increased based on what your base. So if your baseline is really well fed, really well looked after, really warm, you know, loving family, then other things that are much smaller. So for somebody else who, you know, can't afford to feed their family, some of the stresses that we might find in our lives are very stressful. They might just not even register on their scale.
I just don't think those people are listening to my podcast.
Yeah, though, that's true.
So that's the qualifier. If you're listening to this podcast, you know, you don't really have to worry about losing your job because you'll just find another one and it'll almost certainly be more exciting than the last one. But yeah, talk about the social isolation piece that you did. I thought was just really wonderful. And of course, we owe that credit to Brian Walsh. I interviewed Brian and we talked about social isolation, and I got an incredible amount of positive feedback on that, especially from the practitioners and naturopathic doctors and other types of doctors that, you know, Brian really is, he's just such an innovator, and he's thinking about things that nobody else is. And he's thinking about them so critically. And he just blew my socks off when he came onto my podcast and talked about social isolation. And I thought it was great. You picked up some papers I don't believe I had seen before. And you talked about the risk to health from social isolation. So why don't you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so I guess if we're going chronologically through my talk, the next thing I talked about was circadian
rhythm. Okay, sorry.
So I talked about light and circadian rhythm. And I just want to bring it up just because I think it's so important. And basically just talking about the fact that your circadian rhythm, like basically on a daily or hourly basis, changes some of the genes, particularly mitochondrial genes, to do with energy metabolism and lots of other stuff. But so basically your circadian biology determines how you respond to food. And if you're sleep deprived, that instantly makes you insulin resistant. If you eat late at night, that makes you insulin resistant the next day. So if you're eating out of phase and getting light out of phase, that increases your risk of obesity and insulin resistance for multiple different reasons. So actually, when we're talking about food, circadian biology basically determines how you respond to food, and it determines a lot of your hunger cues and your food intake. So if people are busy worrying about food, they really need to worry about their circadian rhythm, because that's what determines how they respond to food.
And it's particularly just ironic, and you were saying that nobody pulled you up on this, which was quite unbelievable, but here in Iceland, it's nearly June. And there basically isn't a nighttime. Like it gets dark. It sort of gets dark at 11 o'clock for a few hours, and then it's light again. Sunrise is officially 4 a.m., I believe. But
yeah, but it's the same.
It's just dark. It's like as dark as it gets. And then, of course, probably half the people in the audience were hospital shift workers.
Yeah.
So, like,
so we did get some questions. Thanks for that, Tommy. Yeah, we did get some questions about that. And it's because we also, afterwards, we talked about the fact that it's very possible. So there was a podcast by Chris Masterjohn that I haven't listened to, but I've seen some of the stuff that he was talking about. Basically, some SNPs in melanopsin genes, which basically determine how you respond to changes in light cues and circadian rhythm. And some people, you know, are very robust, you know, and can deal with having a circadian rhythm out of like context with the sort of the light cues, and that doesn't really cause any problems. And some people, it really, really affects them. So it's very possible. My theory that we haven't really been able to find, if anybody's studied this, is that actually the further you get away from the equator, the more robust your system is at dealing with those huge changes in light cues. Because obviously in the winter it's dark all the time, and in the summer it's light all the time. So it's very possible that we've sort of adapted to that. But it is, in general, hugely, hugely important. It's sort of like the step up. I think it's the step up above food, because actually, you know, sleeping properly, particularly getting good quality sleep, you know, is one of the things that, and getting access to light at the right times of day actually basically just tells you, you know, determines how you respond to food.
So back to social isolation.
Yeah, so back to socialization. And so basically the podcast that Brian did was awesome. You know, I loved it. So if people haven't listened to that, you should stop listening to this and go and listen to that. he tells a story at the beginning about when people are part of a community and have like a goal in life, they have a role, be a doctor or a farmer or something like that, as part of a community that gives you, that puts your immune system in a certain state. And then when you're isolated, that changes because it needs to be more vigilant for, you know, if you're attacked or you break a bone or something like that, and you actually increase inflammation, certain types of inflammation in that setting. So I obviously credited his name and told people that I was stealing his story because it's a really nice story. It sort of illustrates it very nicely. And then I showed some data, basically that risk of almost every modern disease and overall mortality increases by 30 to 40, around 30%, actually. It seems to be the same in almost every meta-analysis. And this is from millions of people. You know, there's huge amounts of data on this. Increases the risk of those diseases by about 30%. And actually, there was one study of 300,000 people, or a meta-analysis, which calculated that the risk of increased risk of mortality from social isolation was the same as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. So, you know, this isn't a trivial thing, you know, and people are increasingly, I think people are increasingly socially isolated because of technology and social media. So you think you have all these friends and you're connected, but in reality, these aren't the people that you can rely on. And these aren't people who rely on you, and you don't have a direct meaning and role in their lives, which can actually then determine how your immune system functions. And there's also I then showed data from a paper which basically looked at again genetic expression in people who either live a hedonistic life or a eudaimonic life. So basically they live for themselves or they live for a greater good, which kind of sounds a bit airy-fairy, but in those people you can actually see lower inflammation in those that have like meaning and a greater goal in life, you know. And this is published in the PNAS, which is a very, very, very well respected journal. It's one of the, you know, one of the best sort of general biomedical journals around. Actually, they publish in all fields. So you know, this is really high quality, interesting data that you can actually see that based on how you live your life, that changes your genetics, it changes your level of inflammation and how your immune system is regulated, and that directly changes your disease risk.
So what's the just tell me what to do part? This is part of something I really struggle with. So, you know, everything you hear about on the podcast and in particular everything that Tommy talks about, they end up in my deck of cards that I use when doing these health sprints where I'll define a set of tasks for people to do in a given period of time. And the social isolation piece, we have some questions in our health assessment questionnaire. So I know when it's happening, you know, I feel part of a group of friends, rarely. Those types of things. And I don't have very good, you know, so just tell me what to do things to solving these types of problems.
Because obviously at any point, if you, you know, you join a group or community, and I think this is where, you know, this is where people are really enjoying CrossFit, say. That's one of the reasons why CrossFit has really taken off, is you become, and I've been a part of many CrossFit gyms, and you become part of this incredible community. And when I first moved, so I spent 2 months in the US when I was just at the end of medical school, when I was doing some medical placements, did some sports medicine, did some infectious disease stuff. You know, it's just sort of part of the end of your medical training. And I went to the US, and I would literally rock up in a new city and I'd turn up at the CrossFit gym, and by the end of the day, I'd be having dinner and some beers with 10 people I'd never met before. And they were all just like, you're new in town, like, cool, let's meet some people, let's just like, you know, we'll show you around. And so that was an immediate way. I did it every new city I went to. That was the way I made friends, and I still have friends from a number of different gyms. I rocked up and they immediately took me under their wing. And so it's that kind of thing. If you can find something that you enjoy doing, that then you immediately become a part of a community. And it's easy to do. You just need to go out into the real world and do it. So I know a lot of people, I give the example of CrossFit because it's really worked. It worked for me, even though I don't think that that's the best way that people should train. I'm not saying it I'm not saying do CrossFit for that reason, but actually it's a really nice way to find a community. And there are lots of ways to do that. You can volunteer or, you know, there are lots of different sports, say like exercise. So sports are a really good way to do it because there are groups and teams and stuff.
Yeah. Cycling's rubbish for that.
Yeah.
It's like when you do a master's mountain bike race, it's a lot of dickish guys shouting at you, you know, on your left. Don't you're ruining my life right now. It's not like that. So yeah, I think I can see how these team sports would be so much better. This is interesting. It's like the penny's starting to drop here that Brian Walsh has been very generous with his time and he's really taken me in particular under his wing. And then to a lesser extent, even you. But really what he's doing for us is he's just contributing to some other cause that's not himself, perhaps.
Yeah, so yeah. That's part of his eudaimonic lifestyle.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's basically, this gift is a bowling ball with his name engraved on it. Yeah. Like from the Simpsons episode. Yeah. So what do we miss there? We talked about stress. We talked about circadian biology. We talked about social isolation. Was there a fourth thing?
Yeah, no. So that was... So I did the movement thing and my fourth thing was social isolation, but it was also, I came under my moniker of love, which was basically just like actually connecting with friends and family, you know, being grateful for them, telling them that you love them, like just that kind of, which I don't think happens nearly enough. And so that kind of came in with the social isolation thing as part of like building a community and building relationships. So that kind of stuff came together and that was essentially it. And then I kind of tied that together with two things. And the first was the blue zones. Which people talk a lot about, and people when they talk about the blue zones, they always focus in on diet because actually it's largely plant based with small amounts of animal products. But in reality, I think their diets are borderline meaningless, except for the fact that they just eat real food that's grown locally. But the rest of the thing is they are huge communities. People have a role in the community for their entire life, essentially until they die. Nobody ever retires. They're active all day. They always have some form of stress modification, be it prayer or being in the wilderness, or, you know, there's multiple different ways that they do that depending on the individual community, and they all sort of have that greater goal. And that, I think that sort of, that shows that how important that is in terms of longevity, because those are the areas in the world where people live the longest. And then I also brought in, like, I just picked up a random health plan out of our client folder.
Oh yeah. That was kind of embarrassing for me. I sat there cringing a little bit. I was like, oh no, what's going to be in there?
But the reason I did it is because, like, I look at these and I'm not the one who makes them, and I'm not the person who people work with directly most of the time. And so
you're the architect, I'm the builder.
Yeah. So I'm just sort of like behind the scenes a lot of the time, but then, so I go in and look at the client folder and yeah, there's some stuff about monitoring blood glucose, and there's always a dietary piece. You know, often we tell people they're under eating, but then like the last 60% of the points are get outdoors, get your family involved, you know, go walking, avoid blue light at night, be part of a bigger community. You know, there's all these different things, you know, making sure you get proper sleep, you know, and there's all that stuff, which I know you've said just basically underpins the treating the gut infection. It underpins, you know, getting on top of fatigue and sort of reversing whatever health problem you have or whatever supplements you have to take or anything like that. Like if you don't do that stuff, the other stuff doesn't work.
Right.
And so that's why I truly believe that if you fix, you know, so if you're socially isolated and you fix that, if you fix your circadian biology, you know, if you move enough, but not too much, if you fix your stresses and you find ways to get on top of your stress, then you don't have to worry about the diet so much. Like the diet's important, but it's secondary to all those other things. And when we're arguing about macronutrients, we're arguing about macronutrients in this chronically stressed, chronically tired, broken human population who don't get a chance to do all those things. And then that stuff becomes really important.
Right.
But the more you don't do that stuff, the more you have to worry about the dietary piece. And I think that's why if you fix that bit, you fix all the stuff that I talked about, then the diet, you know, doesn't quite fall out of the mix, but then it's much easier to navigate.
I just care about stuff that works. Yeah. You know? That's what I'm drawn to.
Yeah.
And if it's dietary, it's dietary. And if it's something else, it's something else. Who cares? I just want to throw all those cards out onto the deck. And I just base the order of things, the health sprints, the iterations. I go, you know, having talked to the person, I try and figure out which are the problems that are most likely to be happening for them right now that are the most important based on the people that we've worked with in the past. and then just go through iterations. But yeah, I just want to make people feel good. I don't really care whether it's high carb, low carb, any of that crap, you know. And I will, if I find new information that proves that I was wrong in the past, I've got no horse in this race, really. I'll just change and just get, that's all I really want to do is help people feel and perform better. But yeah, that was very generous of you to mention us like that in the presentation.
Well, I think, Jen, and what I said in the presentation as well is like, so you know, just in this week, there've sort of been all this amazing feedback coming back from various clients. And these are people who I haven't interacted with at all. And so just kind of seeing the benefits that people are getting. But we also work with, and you and I are spoken to quite a few people, you know, more in depth, who, you know, these are people who they've worked with literally the best functional medicine doctors in the world and not seen benefit. And then they've seen at least more benefit, I believe, when they've come to work with us. And I truly believe it's because we focus on all of it. And it's not just doing the most expensive test. It's not just taking the most expensive supplement or taking the fanciest gut cleanse protocol. Like, if you don't fix all the other stuff, I really don't think that then what you're, you know, the active interventions you're trying to do to fix the gut or treat an infection or whatever, I don't think they're going to work as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I should mention that in some cases that fantastic feedback was coming to us from clients that I've never spoken to. And Amelia and I work on all the plans together. We look at the test results together and we have phenomenal ways to communicate over the internet to do that very efficiently. But in some cases, it's not me that's talking to the person and it's her that's doing the building, if you like. And so, yeah, I think it's incredible that we've got, you know, such a great team that's able to, and you don't really want that, right? So if you're thinking about working with us right now, you don't really want it to be just Tommy or just me, because what happens if we go away? What happens if I get hit by a bus tomorrow, right? Like, you don't want just a single point of contact. You want there to be a team. I think that's one of our strengths. Well, cool. This has been great. Thank you very much, Tommy. Excellent. Okay. Well, if you've got any questions or think of anything else, maybe I'll just chop this part off. Okay. Yeah, okay. That's the end. Cheers then. Bye-bye.